This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to begin by outlining the broad parameters of the project as a whole that I'm working on, and then segue into two sections that deal both with Whitman's relationship to history, particularly political history, and then his conceptualization of politics and poetics. So the first section is painting in very broad strokes and slightly polemical, but will hopefully at least open up some avenues for discussion. The expression writing revolution can be read in numerous ways, and its polysemy leads in multiple different directions. To begin with, it refers to a revolution in writing, meaning a fundamental reconfiguration of the very practice of literary expression. And it's arguable in this regard that there has been a writing revolution since approximately the latter third of the 18th century, in the sense that there's been a deep reconfiguration of the very practice of writing, including significant stylistic changes, the emergence of free verse, the development of the modern novel, a partial dismantling of genres, the appearance of aesthetics as such, both in the sense of aesthetic practice and the philosophy of art. Here, of course, I'm thinking and drawing on both the work of the early Michel Foucault on the category of la littérature and Rancière's work as of the mid to late 90s on the same category. Moreover, this writing revolution was not unique to the practice of discursive production. It is also linked to very significant changes in the circulation and reception of writing. Literacy rates skyrocketed during this period. New modes of technological reproduction allowed for the prolific production and circulation of cheaper texts. Novel forms of transportation, particularly the railroad, facilitated more rapid and expansive distribution of these texts. And social changes brought new readers, including perhaps most notably the feminine readership, which was so crucial to the development of the modern novel. In all of these ways, then, the expression writing revolution refers both to a reconfiguration of stylistics and the practice of writing and to the larger social inscription of practices of writing. But secondly, the expression writing revolution can refer to the process of providing a narrative account of revolution, meaning writing the story of revolution. With all of the changes that came about via what are called the modern social revolutions and the industrial revolution, this became a very pressing question in many fields. And given all of the profound changes that were occurring, one of the central questions was how can we make sense of them? And here, of course, I'm thinking about the development of the 19th century novel in Europe, but not only in Europe, and an attempt to give accounts of a social world that had been radically transformed by the social revolutions and the industrial revolution. Hugo, Balzac, Stendhal, Dickens, the list goes on. The question, then, that I would like to begin with is the following. What is the relationship between these two forms of writing revolution? How can we understand the relationship between the revolution in writing and the writing of the story of revolution? Is it simply by chance that literature, in the modern sense of the term, as well as aesthetics, emerged in precisely the same context as revolutionary politics? One of the reasons I've engaged so extensively with the work of Jacques Rancière is precisely because he has arguably come closer than any theoretician to formulating and engaging with these and related questions. At the same time, it is ironically at the exact moment of greatest proximity to these issues that he undertakes an abrupt about-face, appearing to flee them at all costs. In many ways, his relationship to these themes recalls one of Lacan's descriptions of Freud's relation to the question of the meaning of love thy neighbor. He appears to raise the question, draw our attention to it, in such a way that he inquires into what it would truly mean to love thy neighbor. But at precisely that moment, he takes flight from the question by finding it absolutely horrendous and an unthinkable idea. The following hypothesis, then, that I would like to put forth, and this is, of course, in a very, very broad sense, is that literature and revolution, at least understood in a particular way, are sister concepts. It is not only that a revolution in social relations requires a new account of social and political life, and that revolutions contribute to new networks of production, circulation, and reception of written works, meaning a new realm of debate and discussion, it is that literature itself revolutionizes discourse by proposing new modes of recounting, novel forms of storytelling. In other words, literature itself is arguably a revolutionary phenomenon in every sense of the term. It is bound up in intimate ways with modern social revolutions, and it reconfigures the functioning and flow of discourse itself. Literature, at least this is, again, a working hypothesis since I'm painting in very broad strokes, is a writing revolution. It writes the story of revolution by revolutionizing the story of writing. This by no means is to suggest that literature itself is necessarily revolutionary, nor does it mean, of course, that all literary writers were contributing in some ways to revolutionary causes. Instead, this is a proposal to interrogate at a deeper level than the analogical thinking of formal commitment, in which one sees an analogy between certain stylistics and certain modes of politics, the relation between literature and revolution. It is an invitation to elucidate the social practice of literature in the material conjunctures of socio-political revolutions. It is an attempt to think literature in terms of a force field of agencies that are writing revolution. Now, with these very broad parameters staked out, I would like to then take a much closer look at Whitman and how he could be understood within this framework. So the second section of my paper is entitled Historical Poetry and the Forging of a Future People. The self-proclaimed bard of America's athletic democracy, Walt Whitman framed his entire poetic project in terms of the need for a deep spiritual revolution that would transform the material revolution of political democracy in America by forming, quote, a nationality superior to any higher known and outtopping the past, end quote. In this light, he describes America as simultaneously the daughter of a physical revolution and the mother of the true revolution. So these are both quotes. The latter are described as revolutions in interior life and the arts. For so long as the spirit is not changed, any change of appearance is of no avail, writes Whitman. The role of transforming spirit falls upon literature and the arts, which are uniquely capable of fashioning a people by providing it with models of existence. Quote, the literature, songs, aesthetics, etc. of a country are of importance principally because they furnish the materials and suggestions of personality for the women and men of the country and enforce them in 1,000 effective ways, end quote. They are the primary vehicles, then, for what we might call, drawing partially on Gramsci, cultural hegemony. This hegemony, however, is conceived of in terms of a cultural force capable of spreading and deepening a democratic revolution that promises to leave aristocratic hierarchies in the past. This is the historical stage, then, upon which Whitman presents his own poetic work and describes his aspirations for a literature of the future. Anchored in a very specific social world and time period, his poetry is situated in a present surrounded by a dual revolution, a past political revolution that is behind it, and a future literary revolution that is to come. Whereas what has occurred in the past with the founding and development of America has primarily been material and physical, the revolution to come is spiritual and cultural. Whitman thereby positions himself at a watershed moment in history, in which the material revolution of politics begins to transform itself into the literary revolution of a new cultural empire via an unprecedented poetry of the people. His work is conceived of as part of the link between past and future, between the political and the poetic. And this connection, I think, is crucial. The political as being behind, the poetic as being future, but the poetic as being an element through the future that can lead us to a new spiritual politics. In other words, it is the linchpin of history, purportedly linking the onset of modern political democracy to the experiment of literary democracy in a profound spiritual renewal. He describes his magnum opus in the following terms, quote, one genesis motive of the verses was my conviction that the crowning growth of the United States is to be spiritual and heroic. To help start and favor that growth, or even to call attention to it, or the need of it, is the beginning, middle, and final purpose of Leaves of Grass, end quote. So in what follows, I would like to unravel the various threads of Whitman's historical account and see how they are intimately woven together, these various threads, in an account of a new world literature as democratic spiritual revolution. To begin with, it is important to emphasize the fact that Whitman's poetry is profoundly historical, in the modern sense of the term history. I could go into this, but I'll leave it as an aside. It is explicitly and repeatedly moored in an extremely specific time and place, which it attempts at once to express, to support, and to advance. A new world literature, he writes, perhaps a new metaphysics, certainly a new poetry, are to be, in my opinion, the only sure and worthy supports and expressions of the American democracy, end quote. Although he clearly admires the poetry of the past and admits that it has been the necessary condition for the development of his own work, he also explicitly identifies it as being part of a distinct era. The old world, he writes, has had the poems of myths, fictions, feudalism, conquest, caste, dynastic wars, and splendid, exceptional characters and affairs, which have been great. But the new world needs the poems of realities and science and of the democratic average and the basic equality, which shall be greater, end quote. It is not only, then, that he positions the classics in a separate and distant past, but this chansonnier of a great future, as he describes himself, inscribes them in a progressive historical narrative, according to which they will be surpassed in the future. In other words, at the same time that the past is rendered autonomous, the future becomes an open horizon of possibility, and above all, of promise. The linear, evolutionary historical model that undergirds his work thereby severs ties with what we might refer to as the classical model, according to which the past houses a set of paradigmatic exemplars that transcend time and need to be imitated in the present and future as the true paragons of art and literature. This cyclical vision of time, in which the duty of the future lies in the repetition of the past, gives way to a more or less unilinear conception of history. And there's thereby a shift from the classical past to the historical past, from the repetitive future to the revolutionary future. The past, we might say, becomes truly past, and the future truly future. Furthermore, Whitman's historical poetry calls into question the very classical distinction between history and poetry, which was prominently theorized by Aristotle in his Poetics and came to function as one of the touchstones in classical art and literature. In the interest of time, I won't read a long Aristotle quote in which he explains the extent to which history and poetry are separate and distinct practices. Whitman, however, breaches this divide. His historical poetry is simultaneously about what is actual and what is possible. It bears on the singular while culling from it the universal. In fact, it is precisely by expressing the singularity of what exists, in this case American democracy in the latter half of the 19th century, that it beckons toward the possible, which is ultimately what he refers to as the restoration of the true idea of nature and the unification of the people under the all. It is here that we see perhaps most clearly the influence of Hegel and more generally the German Romantics on Whitman. The historical process of poetic forms that he describes is one of a gradual synthetic unification in which the singularities of history contribute to a universal future that poetry is tasked with both expressing and shepherding. Merging history and poetry in a manner that recalls, moreover, Vico's extremely powerful analysis of Homer as a quintessentially historical figure, right, that Homer, qua figure, not person, was a poet insofar as he was a witness to a particular historical state of a language and a specific culture. Whitman's testimonial poetry, we might say, is a poetry of the future and a forger of facts. In giving voice to what is before it, it expresses the soul of a nation while simultaneously forming and sculpting it. And it is this dual status that is at the heart of its modus operandi. As historical, it describes and expresses a particular cultural state of affairs. However, in doing so, it also, qua poetic, forges and molds for the future the very thing that it is describing. If Whitman holds a mirror up to nature, to borrow the famous Hamlet line that Lukács wrote extensively on, then we might say that this mirror is transformative rather than simply mimetic. It consolidates an image of what exists in such a way that it simultaneously appeals to what it could become. It is thus a form of Bildung, or education formation, binding the past of history to poetic futures. Now, this operative understanding of historical poetry as a two-way cultural formation allows us to further elucidate the relationship between literature and politics in Whitman. The reason that poetry is political is that it functions as the spiritual and cultural forge of the people. Politics, in the restricted sense of the term, primarily addresses material aspects of collective existence. If it is a necessary condition for the forming of states, it is in no way a sufficient condition for the cultivation of its spirit and what Whitman tends to call nationality. Quote, "For the first time in history, a great aggregated real people, worthy of the name and made of developed heroic individuals, both sexes, is America's principal, perhaps only, reason for being. If ever accomplished, it will be at least as much the result of fitting and democratic sociologies, literatures, and arts, if we ever get them, as our democratic politics." End quote. What politics is then to the body, we might say poetry is to the soul. In this sense, the American Republic can be understood as an unprecedented body politic that has yet to fully develop its own soul, which only a new world literature can provide. This historical poetry therefore sets as its task the transformation of democratic matter from the past into the spirit of a new people to come, which promises to be superior, in his mind, to all former civilizations. Democracy, Literary and Otherwise is the title of my third section, and I should watch 20 after. So Whitman's literary project is explicitly dedicated to singing the praises of American democracy and furthering its cause. Historically, this is both significant and singular, for although contemporary common sense tells us that the United States was founded as a democracy, it was in fact explicitly established as a republic in stark opposition to a democracy. In the terminology of the Enlightenment, a republic guaranteed proper governance because it was rooted, among other things, in a clear distinction between an elite class of learned individuals who knew how to govern and the masses who were uneducated and needed to be governed. Of course, the former were generally adult, white, male, deist, property-owning individuals of European descent, and the latter were everyone else, meaning that it was a tiny, tiny minority of the population that was in power. I'm going to summarize a bit of what I have and a couple of the quotes in order simply to highlight that what occurred through the course of the 19th century around the category of democracy is quite fascinating. It's that the institutional system that was established at the end of the 18th century after the American Revolution was an oligarchic republic. It was an elitist rule of the few, the property-owning European class and male. The term democracy, as of approximately 1830, became more and more used, particularly with the rise of the candidacy to the presidency of Andrew Jackson and a new populist politics that was attempting to make a greater appeal to the people. There was, however, no structural change to the government itself, meaning that what we have through the course of the 19th century is a relabeling of an oligarchic republic as a democracy. There's an excellent quote by Auguste Blanqui, writing in the mid-19th century, explaining the extent to which democracy and democrat are rubbery terms. He describes them as un mot en caoutchouc. And he adds, "Beware of words lacking definition. This is the favorite instrument of schemers. Everyone purports to be a democrat, above all the aristocrats." Now, Whitman significantly contributed to the cultural valorization of the term democracy, like Tocqueville before him and others as of about the mid-19th century. And he also contributed to the revisionist history regarding the supposed democratic founding of America, which is an absolute myth. He appears to have lacked the incisive critical acumen of the young Arthur Rimbaud, whose poem Democracy, written at the onset of the brutal colonial endeavors of the French Third Republic, stands in stark contrast to Whitman's work and comparable poems like For You, O Democracy. I've circulated these two poems. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read them, but what's important for me is the extent to which Rimbaud directly identifies the term democracy as being a flag for brutal colonial oppression of the world, whereas Whitman's discourse is more or less the mere opposite of that. Democracy is this woman to whom he is singing these songs in the name of developing a new people. Whitman's embrace, then, of democracy was, however, by no means blind, and it was very much oriented toward the future, as is clear, for instance, in his repeated use of the future tense in this poem itself, or again in the closing lines of To a Historian, where he writes, "Chanter of personality, outlining what is yet to be, I project the history of the future." It's a phenomenal line for Whitman. What he's writing is a history of the future. Right? He's writing a poetic history in the sense that poetry gives us the futural dimension lacking in history in the common sense understanding of the term. Whitman was vigilantly aware of many of the limitations of the current state of so-called democracy in his day and age. In particular, he underscores the limitations of the vulgar, soulless democracy driven by material gain and business interests. The justification for his own literary project, as well as his clarion call for a new world literature, is precisely in terms of the need to transform this material democracy into a spiritual democracy that's capable of begetting new personalities and an unprecedented nationality. Whitman thereby dedicated himself to creating a veritable poetry of the people in the double sense of the term. His is a poetry from the people insofar as it draws on the common population as a source and inspiration, but it is also a poetry for the people by being dedicated to cultivating the democratic spirit and of the general population. Whitman was clearly a trailblazer in singing the praises of commoners, including farmers, the working class, women, foreigners, children, animals, plants. He writes, for instance, in Salut au Monde, quote, "I see ranks, colors, barbarisms, civilizations. I go among them. I mix indiscriminately, and I salute all the inhabitants of the earth," end quote. There is present in his work an aesthetics of absolute equality, by which he remakes the poem into a song of the open road that is for everyone and everything. Again, this is a poem that I circulated. I'll just read the opening and closing lines where he writes, "Hear the profound lesson of reception, nor preference nor denial. The black with his woolly head, the felon, the diseased, the illiterate person are not denied," on and on and on. "They pass," he says at the end, "I also pass. Anything passes. None can be interdicted. None but are accepted, none but shall be dear to me," end quote. He embraces, moreover, the dirty and the downtrodden, the clamor of modern cities, the banality of the average, social and cultural detritus, the physical and the fluid, in the highly pronounced sexual sense of the term. Now, in foregrounding the egalitarian strain in Whitman's writings, we must not lose sight of what I would call the Janus face of democracy, which has not been sufficiently emphasized, in my opinion, in the literature on Whitman. All too often, the politics of a work of art, in this case Whitman's own poetry, is reduced to one particular attribute, and Whitman is elaborately praised in the secondary literature for being the bard of democracy. However, works of art have more than one dimension, and they rarely confine themselves to a single position, particularly if we're talking about an entire corpus. In other words, the politics of art, I would argue, or have argued as well, is constitutively multivalent. A work of art doesn't have a singular political power. It has multiple political dimensions, and those dimensions can be differently actualized by those who engage with it. So in the case of Whitman, it is extremely important to remind ourselves that in a book like Democratic Perspectives, he sings the praises of the American Republic as being open to all, but he also lauds capitalist and imperialist expansion. He supports the manifest destiny of the United States. He speaks at times of a supposed superiority of the American race. He advances a feminism founded on the reduction of woman to mother. He denigrates at times the miserable and ignorant, at the same time, of course, that he celebrates the people, and intermixes his criticisms of the social moral failures of democracy with an irrepressible admiration for the material and financial advances of the United States. In other words, while being a poetry oriented towards a future people, it is also an imperial poetry that is aiming in part at expanding and developing the supposed manifest destiny of the United States. And so I'd just like to say, in drawing my conclusion and echoing back to the core theme of this meeting or series of meetings, that Whitman, in thinking the politics of poetry, is thinking this politics in such a way that it is simultaneously a clarion call for the development of a particular nation state and an imperial endeavor to spread the forces of that nation state around the world. And one way I think of latching on to this dual aspects of Whitman's project is in terms of an expression that comes back regularly in his writings. That is the expression of a need for a new world literature. This expression is, of course, a perfect double entendre, right? It's a double, it has a dual meaning. On the face of things, it appears that Whitman is talking about a literature of the New World and advocating the rise of a new national literature like many others in the mid-19th century in America, and that's certainly the case. But at the same time, this New World literature is the reference to the ways in which American literature is supposed to become, if his hopes are realized, the new literature of the entire world. So that there's a short circuit between the literature of the nation state and the literature of the world, or between the people and the empire. In this sense, I think that Whitman invites us as well to rethink the very category of nation state literature and not follow some simplistic historical lines that suggest that, well, through the course of the 19th century, the literature itself was bound up with the formation of the nation state, consolidation of national languages, etc., which is absolutely the case, and there's so many instances thereof. But what Whitman is gesturing towards is the extent to which the national is always already the international, insofar as it's an inscribing of limits, geographic, cultural, etc., that presuppose an outside to those limits, or a distension of those limits in the case of the imperial endeavors and the manifest destiny of the United States. And so it's all of these dimensions, I think, that we have to take into account in grappling with the political multivalency of Whitman's poetry. Thank you.